Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Welcome back to the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway. Cameron Mills not with us today. I've been, I guess, not getting as many episodes out lately as I think a lot of people are used to. And that hopefully will change soon, but I've just been very, very busy. But the topic that I want to tackle today has to do with a lot of what has been going on in recent days. And I just want to say one more time to make this very clear. I am 100% in support of protesters who are peaceful and who have, I think, legitimate concerns that America needs to have a discussion about. But I also want to make sure that you understand that there are two different groups. The people that are being aggressive, that are hurting people, that are attacking people, that are involved in rioting, those are not the protesters. And oftentimes they have nowhere near the same goals in mind. So we're talking about two different groups. So I stand in solidarity with my brothers and sisters who want to see justice for everyone. I was watching a documentary on television the other night about our DNA history. And I thought while I was watching this, I was talking about how how interconnected we actually all are. All races are interconnected throughout history. And I stopped the TV and I looked at my wife and I said, how stupid does partisanism, does tribalism, does hatred, does anger, does war, does fighting, does racism sound? Because I would like one of these people who actually thinks other races might be different or less equal to them to take a DNA test. And then they'll find themselves either having to hate themselves or wise up, right? But one of the things that's sort of boiled up in all of this is the discussion about statues. And of course, I share a lot of people's concerns about tearing down statues just for the sake of tearing down statues. It's happening all across the country. I saw a very hilarious meme on social media of the Statue of Liberty where the Liberty Lady is hiding behind the pedestal of the statue afraid she's going to get taken down, right? It's crazy. Orwell talked about this in 1984, erasing history and keeping sort of an ever-present present, which allowed for the control of people's minds and thoughts. It's a very dangerous, slippery slope. On the other hand, there are some statues in some places that I believe should come down because of what they mean, what they stand for, what the context of that statue is. And I want you to listen to this conversation all the way through because I also believe that conservatives, Republicans in specific, but conservatives in general, need an effort at rebranding because I believe in liberty for everyone. And until every single American, regardless of the color of their skin, feels like they have the freedom to pursue their own liberty and prosperousness and happiness, we will not have achieved that perfect union that our system sets up for us to achieve. So with that, I want to bring in Dr. O.J. Olika. He is the president of the Association of Independent Kentucky Colleges and Universities. He's a fascinating individual. He is an African-American who is a conservative and has very, very interesting opinions on all of this stuff. And I thought it'd be good to hear from him and get his perspective. Dr. Olika, thanks for coming on. How are you?
I'm well, Leon. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you. First of all, tell me a little bit about your organization. I went to Asbury University, which is a member of the Association of Independent Kentucky Colleges and Universities. What do you guys do?
Yes, well, you can call us IQ for short. We have a very, very long name, but we're thrilled that you went to Asbury. You're one of our people, as I like to say. And what we do is we make sure that all of our institutions, there are 18 of them across Kentucky, have great representation with regard to advocacy at the public level, whether it's state or federal, with regard to policies that matter. Also, making sure that there are financial resources at the state level for low-income students with regard to scholarships. And we also make sure that we can combine resources to lower costs for these institutions and also develop programming for their staff. It's a common misconception that IQ institutions or the independent colleges, the Bellarmines of the world, the Bereas of the world, the Center Colleges and Transies, that they're just for the elite kids, but that's not true. We actually have the same percentage of first-generation low-income students as the public colleges and universities, except we graduate them with manageable debt, and we also make sure that they make good money when they come out. So we're proud of what we do, and we're excited for all the money that they pump back into students to make sure that they can have an affordable college experience.
I was one of those less fortunate, I don't want to say less fortunate because I was actually super fortunate. My parents are missionaries.
That's great.
So we didn't have a ton of money. My parents put all of their own money into the mission field. So on paper, it looked like we had money, but in reality, we didn't. And so I had to forge my own way, but I'm glad I did. I wouldn't have changed anything in the world, but I'm living proof that someone who doesn't come from money can go to a private university that has a great standing in academia and come out of that and then do very well on the other side. So, well, yep. I wanted to talk to you specifically about statues and the Jefferson Davis statue. You, that was in the rotunda in the capital of Kentucky, you gave a speech there supporting taking it down. But I know that you are not for this wave of, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're not for, I don't think, this wave of tearing down statues all over the place. But you had a specific reason for why that one should come down. Take it away.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you are correct. I am not for this wave of tearing down any statue just because it's a statue of somebody who's not currently alive. I'll say it like this. I'm a firm believer in learning history. Mm-hmm. And I'm against tearing down existing statues just to tear them down. And I'm definitely against destroying any of them just to destroy them. But I think it's important to contextualize them and put them in a place where they can be contextualized. Mm-hmm. And part of the speech that I gave was there's a difference between learning history. And I think all forms of history should be learned. It's important that we understand what got us to where we were today as a country, as a world. There's a difference between learning history and celebrating it. And I don't think all history from all perspectives should be celebrated. And that's why I was in favor of the Jefferson Davis statue coming down. I mean, Davis didn't even claim Kentucky as his home, even though he was born here.
Right.
And he was president of a government that was anti-liberty. I mean, no matter how you slice it, and I understand the heritage arguments and the states' rights arguments and those things, the Confederacy was a government that was designed to oppress liberty. I mean, it was designed because of the support of human bondage. And that's not something that Kentucky represents. It's not something that I believe in as a conservative. And so I think that the statue needed to come down. But to quickly say, I mean, again, this Jefferson Davis is not Thomas Jefferson. It's not Winston Churchill. I mean, there are levels to this, or there are different degrees. Right. Each statue should have its own standard and be judged for the totality of the contributions of the individual. It's also important, as you mentioned, to get the context in which the statues came up. The Jefferson Davis statue came up in the early 20th century. That's when it was put in the Capitol by a movement to memorialize and sort of recreate what the Confederacy was about. I think that's a different idea altogether.
I couldn't agree more. It's kind of funny, my views of the Confederacy in terms of, as I've, my wife and I love to study the Civil War. It's an interesting period in history.
Yeah.
It's a sad period in history. But, you know, I grew up on an Indian reservation. My parents are missionaries to the American Indian field. And so I'm also fascinated with the history of Native Americans and our interactions with them. Mm-hmm. And something that really strikes me about all of this is that we have to look at history. I think an intelligent person like yourself and like myself can look at America's history and say, we set up a system that allowed us to become more perfect. But in the beginning, we had to have that system because we were not perfect. And
right.
It's looking at history through the lens of what was the context of those times. And when we erase that, we run into trouble. But
yes.
The reason I agree with you about the rotunda statue is because, and I told somebody this, my friend and I were actually having a debate about this the other day. And I said, it's the context of being in the people's house. The rotunda is symbolic of where all Kentuckians can go to address their grievances to the Kentucky State Legislature, either the Senate or the House. It sits in the middle. And there are other great Kentucky heroes there. Abraham Lincoln, we are so proud that he was the president of the United States and he was from Kentucky.
Right.
And so because all of the other statues that are there, Henry Clay, the great compromiser, Ephraim McDowell, you know, the great well-known medical professional. So we're celebrating them all. How can we say then that we are not celebrating Jefferson Davis? It's interesting that both presidents of the Confederacy and the United States came from Kentucky, but it's not necessarily something we necessarily need to celebrate other than to say, hey, that was interesting. And it was indicative of Kentucky's culture of never knowing which side it's on sometimes. You know what I mean? And then having problems with brother against brother. But other than that, it's not celebratory, you know?
Well, and I agree completely. And I'll actually add to that in the sense that because both Lincoln and Davis were from Kentucky, it shows that Kentuckians know how to do this type of thing in terms of struggling with very difficult, very granular and contextual ideas. This isn't new to us. And like you said, brother against brother, it's difficult to choose sides in the moment. That is important to understand and learn with regard to who we are as Kentuckians. But as you mentioned, it has no place in the people's house today.
I think I've gotten to the point now where I always find it kind of funny when I see somebody flying the American flag and the Confederate flag at the same time. And I'm always like, dude, what are you doing? This flag here was trying to break away from and destroy and defeat this flag here. This flag here was trying to hold the Union together. I understand the heritage argument. I'm not offended. I don't make automatic assumptions that people who like the Confederate flag or have it are racist. But this is where I kind of get to the part about the branding issue with conservatism, right? We have to, like, I believe that conservatism is the ideology that leads most people out of oppression. It leads most people out of poverty. It is about liberty. And I want to look at and reflect on history. I want to celebrate parts of history. I want to be honest about other parts of history. I don't want those to go away, but I also want to recognize that, you know, I think it would do well for Republicans to say, you know what, we're going to make a pivot here and we're going to stand with liberty and equality for all, period. Equality under the eyes of the law, period. We're going to stand with it. It bothers me sometimes that those on my side of the political aisle are also the ones that can't see the difference between a Jefferson Davis statue in the rotunda and, say, a Thomas Jefferson statue, which is an entirely different thing, like you said.
Yes. I mean, and I agree. I agree completely. I am on your side of the political aisle, and that is a little bit frustrating from my perspective as well. You look at someone like Russell Kirk, who was an American conservative philosopher post-World War II, so sort of the modern era. And one of the things he regularly talked about was this idea that conservatism is the preservation of personal liberty and moral order in society. Mm-hmm. And I wrote an op-ed about this recently, and it feels like those two things can't coexist, but that's the exact idea of what conservatism is. It makes sure that we learn from the wisdom of the ages, and the wisdom tells us that slavery is pretty bad, liberty is pretty good, and we should be on the side of liberty in any single situation. We ought to preserve the systems that work. We remove the ones that don't. We update the ones that need updating, but that doesn't mean you get away from traditions that are positive. And I think that's what our side, if we focus on, and say, what is the best way for every person to participate in the American experiment? How can we set up systems and design ways for people to do that? And then if they choose on their own, whether it's someone who comes from a low-income background, someone who comes from wealth, or someone who's this race, or someone who's this ethnicity, if they choose to not participate with everything at their disposal, well, then that is their individual choice. They have thrown away their own liberty. But if they were never given the opportunity to begin with, because the school they went to from birth was never going to be any good, the communities that they lived in from birth were never going to have any jobs, well, that's not really the outcome of opportunity.
Right.
That is, in fact, the worst outcome that you want, which is no one had a chance from the beginning. So it's something that I think we need to push for with regard to realizing that everybody should have the opportunity to thrive. And if they don't, that's not conservatism. That's in their area.
Right. Let's play a little bit of the other side here, though.
Sure.
Let's talk about the difference between, say, the Jefferson Davis, and I want to come back to the economics, too, but the Jefferson Davis statue and the Thomas Jefferson statue. So the number one argument I hear is it's a slippery slope. It's a slippery slope. And look, I've used the slippery slope argument before in the past on issues, and sometimes it's applicable and sometimes it's not applicable at all. And I think the fear is we see this sort of mob marching through the country, literally tearing anything and everything down. They were tearing down statues of Christopher Columbus. They were tearing down statues of in Philadelphia, they tore down a statue. I think it was Philadelphia. They tore down a statue of an abolitionist.
I did see that.
I was like, do you even know? You know, there's this. So I can understand the fear of the slippery slope because it looks this mob will come for everything. They will come for the Thomas Jefferson statues. And if anybody's ever explored Monticello, which I have multiple times, I lived in Virginia for a while. That guy was a complicated man. You know, he was a very complicated man. He owned slaves. He was a very complicated man. He was a broke man. He was always scheming, trying to find another way to make money. He was an interesting fellow who was not perfect. So why would we protect one but not the other? Because we know that the other side or the other side of this argument is to say, well, if we take the Davis statue down, then they're going to come for the Washington statue because he owned slaves and the Thomas Jefferson statue and et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. And I think it is fair to have that conversation with regard to the slippery slope. I think you can end that slope, I guess, in a few different ways. One, it is important to understand the individual context of when each statue went up, again, where they are, in the totality of the individual. I'm a Christian. I'm a believer in Jesus Christ. I know that you are as well.
Yes.
And one of the most important figures in the Bible is David in the Old Testament, another complicated man who committed many egregious sins. Again, all sins are equal in the eyes of God, but the way that we would look at them in society were pretty bad. I won't dive into those here.
He had a woman's husband killed so that he could sleep with her.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So David, as you mentioned about Jefferson, I'm not necessarily comparing the two, was a complicated man, but he was a man after God's own heart, which means that people change, people reform, but people are people. We are fallen individuals. We make mistakes in significant ways that have awful consequences for many, many people.
Right.
So I'm not saying that you can't put up statues and celebrate individuals who are flawed, because we all are.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the contributions of Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or a Churchill, as I mentioned before, they simply far outweigh the contributions of someone like Jefferson Davis and what they stood for and the words that they stood for and the things that we can use those words to promote far outweigh what Jefferson Davis stood for. I mean, George Washington is a pillar of leadership under a time of stress, forming a country, giving up power. That's exactly what we want leaders to do. That's a model that we should promote. Thomas Jefferson, of course, in terms of founding the University of Virginia and writing the Declaration of Independence, these are inspirational things, to be educated, to be free. As you mentioned, they did not apply to everybody when Jefferson wrote those words, and Jefferson himself was a part of that complication. But it doesn't mean you take away from what they represent. And so I think when you're able to tell those stories, you should absolutely tell the full complicated nature of who Thomas Jefferson was, who George Washington was, and Churchill and the rest. But there is no fuller story like that for some folks like Davis, again, specifically that statue in the rotunda. So I hear that argument, and it is nuanced, and some of it is difficult. But I think we owe it to ourselves as a free-thinking people. Again, I work as the president of an education association. As a free-thinking people who desire to be educated, we owe it to ourselves to make sure we know the difference between the two, so we don't erase history, because that's important.
Yeah, I think you just hit on something, OJ, and that is that to understand the difference between a Jefferson Davis statue and a Thomas Jefferson statue requires knowledge, history, and intelligence.
That's right.
You have to be able to recognize, for instance, like Jefferson is my favorite president from this perspective. Again, very flawed individual. But because he wrote documents and authored documents, him along with James Madison, that forced America to have the conflict that we had to settle the question. It was impossible for us to stare at our hypocrisy in the face, to say
that
all men are created equal under God, you know, basically. And then to stand there and say that with on one side of our mouth, on the other side, while we owned men. Right. And we were forced to face that hypocrisy. And I think there were some founding fathers who understood that. And in the context of the times, perhaps we would consider them to have been braver had they made that stand at that point. But we also wouldn't have created the Union, which would have then created the setup, which would have then created the possibility of dealing with that issue once and for all. So, again, it's complicated and it requires an intelligent look at history and a contextual look at history.
Yes, and even there, you demonstrate the difference between Thomas Jefferson and Jefferson Davis. With Davis, there is no argument. There's no conversation to be had. He chose his side, and he was very clear on why he chose it. But with Thomas Jefferson, he gave us, at least, as you mentioned, the language to have the conversation and to move forward to be a more perfect union, which is essential for any country to survive, which, again, is the importance of preservation when you think about conservatism.
Right. Now, let me go back to kind of the economics and the other side of this conversation, because from your perspective, and I know you've given a lot of thought to this, how might conservatives tackle this issue of, say, income inequality? And I was talking to a friend the other day, and I was kind of explaining. I said, here's one of the issues and why I think conservatives need to be more proactive in some of the issues regarding race and racial inequality in America right now. And a lot of people hear, when they hear me say that, they hear me say, oh, we should start spending money for pro. No, that's not what I'm saying. We need to be more proactive in recognizing that there are people alive today who could not buy houses in certain parts of Louisville because of redlining. There are people alive today who could not eat at the same restaurants that my grandparents could eat at, right? Yep. I think we need to understand that and say, okay, there are poverty is generational, and there are consequences that are still in play from what was happening 50, 60 years ago. I was not part of that. I was not part of that. And to the extent that I should blame myself and get down on my knees and apologize to the world, that's not true. But what I should do, because I see that those effects still linger, is I should try to figure out a way to take the message of liberty and freedom to those areas and communities and join together with those people to make sure that the vestiges of those horrible things are completely erased from our society. What's the best way to do that, in your opinion?
I'll give you two very specific examples of the problem, and then two very specific examples of what is being done in terms of a solution. There was a prominent medical journal that came out with a study about 4 years ago. It's the PNAS journal. It's the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. Long title, again, but basically it did a study on the racial bias and pain assessment and treatment recommendations between Black patients and white patients. And it found that roughly 50% of people who took the study, these were white medical students and just white members of the community, believed that Black people had thicker skin than white people and believed that they could feel less pain. This was a study that was done 4 years ago. So it was in the 1800s or the 1900s. This was 4 years ago. And what that tells us is that when you look at other statistics that show that the health outcomes in the Black community are lower than their white peers, and that the mortality rates, when it comes to maternal mortality, and these are women who die at the time of giving birth, are higher for Black women, you start to put those statistics with this study, it shows you that there is a bias that remains within the medical community in some instances, mm-hmm. where they simply believe that Black people can handle more pain. So if you're in chronic pain for maybe 10 or 20 years because no one helped you fix whatever the issue was 10 or 20 years ago, well, then you might die sooner. So what Norton Healthcare is doing in Louisville is they are investing their private dollars, which, again, that's their prerogative. That makes sense to do. They're investing their private dollars in several initiatives to improve the health outcomes of Black communities in Louisville, to provide affordable health care for Black communities in Louisville, and to also train their staff to ensure that these biases don't continue. This is something that they're doing on their own and has nothing to do with government interaction or government prescription. This is what people in the private sector have decided to do. And then the second thing, you mentioned redlining. There were laws that were passed at the federal level, obviously the GI Bill, that depending on your vantage point could be considered some of the reasons why people have wealth today. Most of the wealth that exists is in people's homes or in their business.
Yeah.
And that's a result in a lot of cases because of education or the labor, the skill that they have been able to develop. The GI Bill allowed families, veterans who came back, to have easier access to education and easier access to homes. Black veterans were largely left out of that, as you mentioned, because of redlining. Banks simply wouldn't give them any loans. The cities that were responsible for doling some of these dollars out just didn't put it in the Black community. So now as a result, you have 70, 80 years later, the difference in wealth between black communities and white communities, black families and white families, is about 10 to 12 times, depending on the Federal Reserve study you look at.
Wow.
Black family has an average of $10,000. White family has an average of $120,000.
Wow.
So what ought to be done, and you see organizations like One West, who's doing this in West Louisville, there need to be concerted efforts, again, of private capital, private dollars, to come to West Louisville, to come to black communities in Louisville, to say, historically, this has been done wrong for you. Mm-hmm. It's not that you don't have the ability. It's not that you don't have the skill. You simply don't have the capital investment. You don't have the cash flow. So when you have those types of associations, organizations, putting private dollars into black communities that have been historically marginalized, that's where you're going to see some significant growth. Opportunity zones is another one at the federal level.
Yeah.
That's good policy.
Senator Rand Paul has led the charge on those, and I think that they make sense in light of that history. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
So why, if you were in charge of sitting down with, say, a President Trump or one of the leaders in the Republican Party right now, what would you say to them in terms of how the Republican Party should maybe make a strategic change here? Because I think conservatism, liberty in general, is missing an opportunity here. I think that the Democrats, I don't want to get into a partisan conversation, but I think the left in America has staked out ground that they aren't really truly, they're not being honest about. And I think the right is ignoring ground that they could really make a big difference in. So what would you advise?
I would agree 100%. And it's two simple sentences. Listen to reform the message. Learn to reform the policy. And I say those two things specifically because if you're listening, that means you're listening to black voters, you're listening to the black community.
Right.
And as a result, you can use the language that resonates and makes the most sense. As we talked about before, I think a lot of us really are saying the same thing. But because we don't have conversations with people who look differently than us, or in the case of conservatives, most conservatives statistically are white, they don't have conversations, detailed, deep ones with regard to race, with the black community. I think if we had more of those conversations and we listened, it'd be easier to form a message that would resonate with the black community, because quite frankly, a lot of black folks are conservative culturally. And then the second one, learn to reform the policy. If you've learned in terms of what the issues are, redlining, health outcomes in terms of the disparities, educational disadvantages, housing disadvantages, the criminal justice system. When you truly learn and recognize that this isn't a group of people who are lazy or dangerous or overly bad compared to their white peers, these are people who have been in communities who have endured pretty significant struggles in a way that was not their own doing. Once you learn that, then you can reform the policy. Again, this can be government or this can be in the private sector, but then you can actually reform the policy to make it make sense. And that's where the opportunity is, because then you have a message that resonates and you have policy that works.
I had a friend who once told me, he said, black people, we're not socialists. We're capitalists.
Right.
We just want a seat at the table. And
right.
And I think sometimes conservatives, because the left has so, at least from the media perspective and what you, it made it appear as though they have captured sort of that vote, whatever to speak, that sometimes conservatives are afraid to make that, you know, make that connection. And it's like, no, this is not, there are not that many differences in terms of policy and thinking and how we approach, you know, all this stuff. If you just, like you said, sit down and listen and talk, and then you go, holy crap, look at all this common ground we found. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like a gold mine of common ground. Yeah, we're going to have differences. That's fine. But look at this gold mine of common ground. Take that and run with it. You know what I mean?
That's exactly right. Black folks have kids, they have jobs, and they want good health. If we can provide conservative responses to those, I think we'll win a lot more.
Yeah. Wow. I love this conversation. Can we do it again? Because I think there's a lot more here than just the Jefferson Davis statue. And I hope that people will listen to this and, you know, I don't expect everybody that listens to this to agree with what we have said here. There's going to be people with justifiable reasons for why they like or don't like. I'm just asking people to listen. I think that's the key. I think what you said is so powerful. Just let's listen to each other, and then let's begin a dialogue that moves us in the right direction.
Yep, I agree. I'd love to do it again.
Yep, awesome. Dr. OJ Olika, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate you being on the Disruption Zone.
Thanks, Leland. I appreciate it.
Have a great day. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. And again, my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, will be back with us shortly. I love what you've done to help make this podcast awesome. Thousands of downloads a week. Please keep sharing it with your friends. It's free. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on Google Play or on iHeartRadio's app. Just search for The Disruption Zone, and we will deliver fresh new episodes directly to your pocket. It's pretty awesome. Thanks to Dynamics Productions for their help as well with all of this, and also to JP Web Design for their help with the website. Again, free download. Follow me on Twitter at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption, and on Instagram at Greatly Londo and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.